Part 2. How to Create Zombies. All socialism involves slavery. Herbert Spencer, British author, economist, and philosopher, 1884. Free people can travel anywhere, at any time they like. They can start a business or a new profession, or even take a vacation for as long as they wish. One sure way to create a slave is to ensure a person is indebted. After all, anyone who cannot do any of the things a free person can do, because he or she has a mortgage, bills of all sorts, and the need for a monthly paycheck, should be considered a slave of sorts, a debt slave. Political hacking. Government is not reason. It is not eloquent. It is force. Like fire, it is a dangerous servant and a fearful master. George Washington. We shall consider politics the representative head of a zombie nation. Politics is a necessary partner in any widespread high-level conspiracy. There is an inseparable blend of political and financial control in modern America. This powerful combination can be found within the Federal Reserve System, in the corridors of Washington and Wall Street, and even in corporate news stories dealing with both politics and finance. Americans do not need an economics degree to figure out that the nation is past bankruptcy. Using the most conservative estimates, there is more than $70 trillion of American debt, compared with about $13 trillion in gross domestic product. This does not include the $300 trillion or more in toxic derivative debt. Foreign trade and bonds. International trade deficits have been draining the nation's reserves by $30 billion to $150 billion each year, and have been for the past 20 years. Furthermore, our industrial, mining, and agricultural institutions have not only been weakened, but in many ways decimated by the movement toward globalization. No new steel foundries have been built in the United States since World War II. The issue of debt is fundamental to understanding the machinations that formed the current economic crisis. By 2008, industry, banking, government, households, and individuals were smothered in debt. Eliminating debt will result in a society that looks far different from the one we have experienced in the past. The New York Times noted in a May 9, 2009 front page report, "The forces that enabled and even egged on consumers to save less and spend more, easy credit and skyrocketing asset values, could be permanently altered by the financial crisis that spun the economy into recession." The forces mentioned in the Times article means bloated salaries, one of the few remaining options to corporations for cutting expenses and balancing the budget. What is seen, then, is the culmination of a restructuring process that has taken place for more than two decades. Whereas the living standard has increased in many former dictatorships, such as Russia and China, it has decreased in the United States, thanks to these forces, controlled by the New World Order plutocrats. Given the consistent transfer of money between nations, is it possible that the economic meltdown was not accidental? Some people claim the so-called bailout is nothing but the largest transfer of wealth in Western history, a panicked effort to shore up the U.S. dollar. Additionally, not only was the U.S. dollar in danger, but its bonds were too. Dollar-based grand net bonds net inflow dropped from an early 2007 high of about $950 billion to a 2009 low of nearly $200 billion, indicating a lack of faith in U.S. money. "The foreign creditors are moving away from the United States, plain and simple," wrote statistical analyst Jim Willey. Willey went on to say, "The U.S. dollar stewards are not demonstrating control, discipline, or even anything remotely resembling honesty or integrity. If not for the U.S. Fed buying most of the U.S. Treasury bonds issued, the long-term interest rates would be rising rapidly and with alarm, hyperinflation. They put the U.S. dollar at grave risk. The Weimar territory lies directly ahead. The Chinese financial market is actually leading the U.S. market on directional turns. Sadly and tragically, the U.S. dollar is stuck in mud, running out of time, awaiting a meat cleaver by foreign creditors. Both China, the world's largest holder of foreign currency reserves, and Russia wield that cleaver. And both have called for a new global currency to replace the dollar as the dominant place to store reserves. One little known and also one of the most unsettling aspects of the 2008 financial tsunami was the 2009 report that China's state-owned Asset Supervision and Administration Commission, or SASAC, might support large enterprises in defaulting on the derivatives contracts that they purchased in 2008 from international banks. The Chinese business had purchased the contracts to protect themselves from rising commodity prices, and if they default on these contracts, it would deal a serious blow to investment banks hoping to sell more derivative hedges in China, which is the world's fastest expanding major economy and top commodities consumer. Another side to the problem is simply that any money China spends on bonds and derivatives is money they cannot loan to us. If China really wanted to spur domestic consumption, the best way to do so would be to stop buying our debt. Even better, they could sell treasuries they already own and distribute the proceeds to their citizens to spend, wrote Peter Schiff, author and president of Euro-Pacific Capital. However, the Obama administration is heavily lobbying the Chinese to get them to step up to the plate and buy record amounts of new treasury debt. Obama cannot have it both ways. He cannot claim he wants the Chinese to spend more, but then beg the Chinese government to take money away from Chinese consumers and loan it to the United States Treasury. In the end, Obama will get precisely what he publicly claims to desire but privately dreads. The Chinese government will come to its senses and stop buying treasuries. This will cause the U.S. dollar to collapse, but it will also allow Chinese citizens to fully enjoy the fruits of their labor. Yet, as the Chinese people begin to buy more of their own products, it will mean fewer products available for export to America. And as they spend more money on goods and services, there will be less money to loan to America. This could only lead to a deeper economic crisis. The situation the United States finds itself in today is in many ways worse than that of the 1930s. More banks have failed than during the Great Depression, and unemployment is reaching levels of that time. But unlike the individuals of the 1930s, many of whom had come from an agricultural background and knew how to fend for themselves, the people in modern America can only look to government for their basic necessities. Could this push to government-regulated socialism be the real agenda behind the contrived financial meltdown of recent years? The difference between today and the Great Depression is primarily about the worth of money. The 1930s experienced a monetary depression. Money retained its value because it was simply hard to come by, and prices were depressed to reflect its scarcity. Today, America is experiencing an inflationary depression. Prices continue to rise because of an inflated money supply. The more money that's in circulation, the less it's worth. Liars' Loans. William K. Black, a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri School of Law in Kansas City, suggested that more than simple greed and incompetence brought about the economic crisis of 2008. In the 1980s, Black led the prosecution against miscreants in the savings and loan scandal. According to Black, the mortgage debacle was centered on the creation of AAA-rated bonds that did not use verified incomes, assets, or employment. These were known as liars' loans. Black pointed out that the liars' loans were deceitful and fraudulent, and the banks involved knew it. Fraud is deceit. And the essence of fraud is, I create trust in you, and then I betray that trust and get you to give me something of value. And as a result, there's no more effective asset against trust than fraud, especially fraud by top elites. And that's what we have, Black told PBS commentator Bill Moyers in April 2009. The Bush administration essentially got rid of regulation. So if nobody was looking, you were able to do this with impunity, and that's exactly what happened. Where would you look? You'd look at the specialty lenders, the lenders that did almost all of their work in the subprime, and that's what's called Alt-A, risky alternative A paper loans, liar's loans. They knew that they were frauds. Black said liar's loans were accomplished by failing to check the information provided by those seeking the loan. He said that often loan applicants were even told they could get a better deal if they inflated their income, job history, and assets. We know that they said that to borrowers, said Black. He pointed out that IndyMac, the federal savings bank that failed on July 11, 2008, specialized in liar's loans. In 2006, it sold $80 billion worth of them, thus producing more losses than the entire savings and loan debacle of the 1980s. And it was all based on fraud. Black explained, liar's loans were known to be extraordinarily bad, and now it was getting AAA ratings. Now, a AAA rating is supposed to mean there is zero credit risk. So you take something that not only has crushing risk, and you create this fiction that it has zero risk. That itself is a fraudulent exercise. And again, there was nobody looking during the Bush years. When they finally did look, after the markets had completely collapsed, they found the appearance of fraud in nearly every file. Black and others have compared the bad loans to the Ponzi scheme charged against Wall Street investment consultant Bernie Madoff. Everybody was buying a pig in the poke with a pretty pink ribbon, and the pink ribbon said AAA, said Black. Although there is no specific law against liar's loans, Black argued that the bankers involved knew they had been made under false representation and that they would never be repaid. The loans were based on deceit, which lies at the heart of the legal definition of criminal fraud. Why was no one prosecuted for these acts of fraud? According to Black, federal investigators did not begin to scrutinize the major lenders until the market had actually collapsed, despite early warnings. The FBI publicly warned in September 2004 that there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud, that if it was allowed to continue, it would produce a crisis at least as large as the savings and loan debacle, said Black. But the investigation didn't happen. Due to the war on terrorism, the Bush Justice Department transferred 500 white-collar specialists in the FBI to national terrorism and refused to replace them. Today, Black noted, there are one-fifth as many FBI agents detailed to investigating mortgage fraud as worked the savings and loan crisis. Graham and deregulation. One of the protections against banksters, a derogatory term combining bankers with gangsters, was the Glass-Steagall Act, which went into effect in 1934 following government hearings revealing how big banks of that day had looted customers for the benefit of a small group of insiders. The act separated normal banking activities, checking and savings accounts and commercial loans, from speculative investment banking, hedge funds, derivatives, and Wall Street investments, in the eyes of the law, and allowed for regulation of the latter type of activity. According to former U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission, or CFTC, chairperson Brooksley Bourne, beginning in the Clinton years, almost all such protective regulation was stripped away. In a 2003 interview with Washington Lawyer, she stated, "One major issue was the enormous growth of over-the-counter, or OTC, derivatives. OTC derivatives had been legally permitted for the first time in 1993 by a regulatory exemption that Wendy Lee Graham had adopted as virtually her last act as CFTC chair. This allowed the growth of a business that is now estimated at over $100 trillion annually in terms of the notional value of contracts worldwide. Alan Greenspan had said that the growth of this market was the most significant development in the financial markets of the 1990s. The market was virtually unregulated and many, many times as big as the trading on the futures exchanges. The Commission had kept some nominal authority over this market, but there were no mechanisms for enforcing the rules. For example, anti-fraud rules were retained, but no reporting was required. The market was completely opaque. Neither the Commission nor any other federal regulator knew what was going on in that market. While Mrs. Graham was chairing the CFTC from 1988 to 1993, that body exempted Enron from regulation in trading of energy derivatives. Graham later resigned from the CFTC and took a seat on the Enron Board of Directors, where she served on its audit committee. Enron, the giant energy corporation whose bankruptcy in late 2001 was the largest in U.S. history to that date, drained more than $10 billion from shareholders and resulted in new regulations and legislation to enhance the reliability of financial reporting for public companies. Due to the massive fraud involved, several Enron executives, including founder Kenneth Lay and President Jeffrey Skilling, were sentenced to prison terms. The accounting firm of Arthur Andersen was found guilty of shredding Enron documents and eventually dissolved, putting 85,000 persons out of work. It should be noted that Wendy Lee Graham is the wife of former Texas Republican Senator Phil Graham, who was forced to resign as senior economic advisor in John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign after describing Americans protesting the economic losses due to malfeasance as a nation of whiners. As a senator, Graham was the chairman of the U.S. Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs during the Clinton administration, and he led efforts to pass banking deregulation laws such as the landmark Graham-Leach-Bliley Act in 1999. The act removed Depression-era laws that prevented banks from engaging in insurance and brokerage activities and was passed by an overwhelming majority of the House and by the Senate unanimously, and was signed into law by President Clinton. Supporters of the bill used an old trick that was used to pass the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. Like the Federal Reserve Act, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act was introduced on the last day before the Christmas holiday and was never debated by either congressional body. This bill, fully initiated by and supported by Republicans, and passed with the support of Democrats during a Democratic administration, clearly demonstrates the collusion of the two political parties when it comes to corporate business. Many economists claim the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act's undermining of the Glass-Steagall Act was a significant cause of the 2007 subprime mortgage crisis and the 2008 global economic crisis. Economist Paul Krugman has described Phil Graham as the high priest of deregulation, and named Graham and Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan as the top two culprits responsible for the economic crisis. Graham's culpability was echoed by CNN, Time, and Britain's The Guardian. Brooksley Bourne described how during the Clinton years, her commission questioned the bailout of large OTC derivatives dealers because they held $1.25 trillion worth of contracts, yet held a mere $4 billion in supporting capital, which meant the dealers had far overextended themselves, leaving the market vulnerable to the very meltdown that occurred in 2008 and 2009. I became enormously concerned about OTC derivatives and thought the market was a nightmare waiting to happen, recalled Bourne. I was particularly concerned that there was no transparency. No federal regulator knew what kind of position firms like Long-Term Capital Management and Enron had in the derivatives markets. Warren Buffett later called OCT derivatives the financial weapons of mass destruction. Bourne said the Fed and Congress rebuffed the CFTC's efforts to reinstate some public protection over the financial field. It wasn't a regulatory effort. We were just asking questions. The concept release didn't propose any rules. Alan Greenspan, Arthur Levitt, and Robert Rubin all said that these questions should not be asked and urged Congress to pass a bill that would forbid the Commission from taking any regulatory steps on over-the-counter derivatives. There were no hearings on that bill. But during a Congressional Conference Committee meeting on an appropriations bill, an amendment was added preventing the Commission from taking any action on over-the-counter derivatives for 6 months. This occurred within a month after long-term capital management's collapse. Professor William Black pointed to the experience with AIG, American International Group, as an example of how the lack of regulation led to obscene profits and market manipulation. The taxpayer-backed bailout of AIG in late 2008 ended up totaling more than $180 billion, a cost equaling the entire savings and loan scandal of the 1980s. In September 2008, AIG's credit ratings were downgraded, and the Fed issued $85 billion in credit to keep the international insurance giant afloat. But the Fed also took a stock warrant for nearly 80% of AIG's equity. The government eventually increased AIG's credit to as much as $182.5 billion. Public outrage ensued from news reports that AIG had retained millions of dollars in bailout money, some of it going for executive bonuses and lavish junkets. AIG bondholders and counterparties were paid at 100 cents on the dollar by taxpayers. Yet the taxpayers had no claim to future profits. In other words, the benefits of the bailout went to the AIG banks while the taxpayers suffered the costs. AIG made bad loans, but with guarantees and charged big fees up front, Black explained. So they booked a lot of income, paid enormous bonuses, and they got very, very rich. But, of course, then they had guaranteed this toxic waste. Those liars' loans are going to have enormous losses. And so, you have to pay the guarantee on those enormous losses. And you go bankrupt. Except that you don't in the modern world, because you've come to the United States, and the taxpayers play the fool. Under Secretary of the Treasury, Timothy Geithner, and Under Secretary Henry Paulson, before him, took $5 billion in U.S. taxpayer money and sent it to a huge Swiss bank called UBS through AIG. UBS was defrauding the taxpayers of America, and we were bringing a criminal case against them. We eventually get them to pay a $780 million fine, but wait, we gave them $5 billion. So the taxpayers of America paid the fine of a Swiss bank. And why are we bailing out somebody who is defrauding us? Some suggested that UBS was given $5 billion because AIG was the largest contributor to Obama's campaign and held much of the toxic derivative paper of Goldman Sachs, the major globalist investment firm once headed by Paulson. Though many Americans saw the AIG deal as simply a massive theft that debased our economy, no one in upper management, other than former figurehead and NASDAQ chairman Bernard L. Bernie Madoff, was ever charged with the crime. According to TARP, Troubled Asset Relief Program, Inspector Neil Barofsky, even by mid-October 2009, AIG executives still hadn't repaid half of the $45 million they promised to return. But by March 2009, the public became enraged when it learned that AIG had paid at least $165 million in executive bonuses from the $180 billion in taxpayer loans to keep the company afloat. AIG Chief Executive Officer Edward M. Liddy told a House committee hearing that he had asked employees to voluntarily give back at least half of their bonuses, although he admitted he had no authority to force them to do so. In December 2008, the U.S. government also took hold of the financing arm of one of the nation's largest manufacturers, General Motors. William Black and others have criticized the government takeover of General Motors, GM, as mere nationalization and have questioned why the president of GM was fired while the bankers who created the economic mess were not. There are two reasons, Black said. One, government officials are much closer to the bankers. These are people from the banking industry, and they have a lot more sympathy. In fact, they're outright hostile to auto workers, as you can see. They want to bash all of their contracts. But when they get to banking, they say, contracts, sacred. But the other element of your question is, we don't want to change the bankers, because if we do, if we put honest people in who didn't cause the problem, their first job would be to find the scope of the problem, and that would destroy the cover-up. Geithner is covering up, just like Paulson did before him. Geithner is publicly saying that it's going to take $2 trillion. A trillion is $1,000 billion. $2 trillion taxpayer dollars to deal with this problem. But they're allowing all the banks to report that they're not only solvent, but fully capitalized. Both statements can't be true. It can't be that they need $2 trillion because they have massive losses and that they're fine. These are all people who have failed. Paulson failed. Geithner failed. They were all promoted because they failed. Geithner denied any failure, claiming he was never supposed to regulate the banking business. During congressional testimony in March 2009, Geithner, who was the president of the New York Fed during much of the credit boom, indicated he had little interest in scrutinizing other banks' activities. "I've never been a regulator, for better or for worse," stated Geithner with surprising candor, adding, "And I think you're right to say that we have to be very skeptical that regulation can solve all of these problems. We have parts of our system that are overwhelmed by regulation." "Overwhelmed by regulation," lamented journalist Bill Moyers over Geithner's comments. "It wasn't the absence of regulation that was the problem. It was despite the presence of regulation, you've got huge risks that build up." Black agreed, saying, "Well, he may be right that he never regulated, but his job was to regulate. That was his mission statement. As president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, he was responsible for regulating most of the largest bank holding companies in America. And he's completely wrong that we had too much regulation in some of these areas. I mean, he gives no details, obviously, but that's just plain wrong." As 2009 drew onward, more financial institutions fell by the wayside, even as the media pumped out heartening stories of an economic rebound and more stimulus activity. In the face of criminal charges, the Alabama bank Colonial Bank Group Incorporated was closed by regulators in August 2009, becoming the 77th failed bank since the start of the year. It was also the largest bank failure since the loss of Washington Mutual Incorporated in 2008. Colonial posted a $606 million second quarter loss in 2009, primarily due to loans to developers and home builders in Florida, a state where the housing industry tanked quickly. The bank failed to meet capital requirements to qualify for TARP funds because it simply did not have enough financial reserves to be eligible for TARP support. "One problem," said Robert Auerbach, formerly an economist with the Financial Services Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives, "is that central bank officials are often too close to the banks they are meant to keep in check. The boards of directors of every Fed bank, including the New York Fed, have 9 directors. 6 of them are elected by the banks in the district," said Auerbach. "So you have the banks in New York electing the directors that are supposed to supervise them." One proven means for keeping the true condition of some banks from the public eye during any reorganization is to retain the officers responsible for the problem in the first place. "As long as I keep the old CEO who caused the problems, is he going to go vigorously around finding the problems, finding the frauds?" asked Black in Moyer's interview. He added, "We adopted a law after the savings and loan crisis called the Prompt Corrective Action Law. And it requires bank officers to close these institutions, and they're refusing to obey the law." When asked if Geithner and others in the Obama administration have engaged in a cover-up along with the banks, Black responded, "Absolutely, because they are scared to death of a collapse. They're afraid that if they admit the truth, that many of the large banks are insolvent. They think Americans are a bunch of cowards and that we'll run screaming to the exits and we won't rely on deposit insurance. Downsizing America. People like Black and Moyers, who are in prestigious positions, fail to mention that the motive behind Geithner's and the bank's financial antics can be traced to secretive globalist organizations such as the Council on Foreign Relations. Moyers also usually fails to mention that he is a member of the CFR, having obviously passed its stringent globalist eligibility requirements. It is in examples such as this that one can see the guiding hand of the globalists in both the world of commerce and of journalism. Another person close to secretive society members was Henry Hank Paulson, the George W. Bush Treasury Secretary who oversaw the bailout of AIG. During both the Bush and Obama administrations, AIG was used to funnel taxpayer funds to certain banks like UBS and Goldman Sachs, where Paulson had previously been the CEO. In 2006, when Bush named Paulson to head the Treasury, the CFR explained the president's agenda in an op-ed piece. Bush essentially set five goals for the new Treasury Secretary: keep taxes low, curb federal government spending to curb the budget deficit, deal with international imbalances, keep investment markets open, support innovation and risk-taking in the private sector to boost U.S. economic growth. Paulson is the right man at the right time to take on issues like these. Despite the fact that IndyMac had failed only days before, on July 20, 2008, Paulson reassured the public that it's a safe banking system, a sound banking system. Our regulators are on top of it. This is a very manageable situation. Paulson had been identified as a key figure in the economic debacle that began in 2008. Time magazine stated, "If there is a face to this financial debacle, it is now his." Noting that Goldman Sachs got the lion's share of taxpayer bailout money, $12.9 billion, William Black declared, "Now, in most stages in American history, that would be a scandal of such proportions that he wouldn't be allowed in civilized society." The tragedy of this crisis is it didn't need to happen at all. Black, along with many other commentators, saw losses in workers' income, securities, pensions, and futures as the result of the misconduct of a relatively few very well-heeled people in very well-decorated corporate suites and their ideologies which swept away regulation. Forbes magazine in 2006 estimated Paulson's personal wealth at $700 million. Black and others acknowledged that the destruction of the U.S. financial system came about due to a lack of integrity on the part of several high government and banking officials, as well as massive conflicts of interest and a loss of morality. But this is simply the view of those unwilling to address the true issue: conspiracy. After studying three separate government reports predicting a coming fiscal doomsday, the chairman of the investment counseling firm, the Weiss Group, Martin D. Weiss, had yet another word in mind. "When our leaders have no awareness of the disastrous consequences of their actions, they can claim ignorance and take no action. Or when our leaders have no hard evidence as to what might happen in the future, they can at least claim uncertainty. But when they have full knowledge of an impending disaster, they have proof of its inevitability in any scenario, and they so declare in their official reports, but still don't lift a finger to change course, then they have only one remaining claim: insanity," he wrote. But it would be insane to actually believe that the nation's money masters are truly insane. The only alternative is conspiracy. The financial meltdown happened because it was engineered to happen. The belief that the economic collapse was orchestrated even reached the mainstream media. In early 2009, Washington insider Dick Morris pointed out to Fox News commentator Sean Hannity how the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, was attempting to bring the U.S. economy under international control by using the excuse that it would merely be coordinating regulatory efforts. The conspiracy theorists who have talked about the New World Order and the UN taking control, they are right. It's happening, he exclaimed. No matter how clearly Dick Morris saw things, only a few in Congress seemed to be getting the message. Texas Republican Representative Kay Granger got it. In an August 2009 letter to constituents, she wrote, "Something happened this week that has serious consequences for each and every one of us, but you probably didn't even know it happened." On Tuesday, August 25, 2009, the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, released their mid-session review. The mid-session review showed that our country is going to be $2 trillion deeper in debt than the White House originally told us at the beginning of this year. That's nearly $6,700 more debt for every man, woman, and child in America. If this doesn't show that the policy of spend, spend, spend isn't working, I don't know what does. The only answer that Washington seems to come up with to deal with all problems is to spend more money on central government programs. Is this merely ineptitude? Or is this proof of a hidden agenda, one designed to force the American Republic into a tightly controlled socialist society? Debt slaves. Permit me to issue and control the money of a nation, and I care not who makes its laws. An oft-repeated paraphrase of Amschel Mayer Rothschild's 1838 quote, "I care not what puppet is placed upon the throne of England to rule the empire on which the sun never sets. The man who controls Britain's money supply controls the British Empire, and I control the British money supply." Economics is the lifeblood of any nation. Many compared President Barack H. Obama's $787 billion economic stimulus package in 2009 to giving blood to a corpse. They feared the stimulus was simply throwing good money after bad, especially in light of health and data gathering provisions that seemed out of place in financial legislation. As the U.S. economy deteriorated, President Obama expanded the Bush administration's policies for bailing out banks and other financial institutions. President Obama explained that sending money directly to taxpayers might seem more appealing, but said it wouldn't be as effective in stimulating the economy, saying that a dollar of capital in a bank can actually result in $8 or $10 of loans to families and businesses, a multiplier effect that can ultimately lead to a faster pace of economic growth. Stimulus package. Obama did not comment on criticism raised over the many improprieties connected to the economic crisis, nor did he comment on the argument that his economic growth actually was nothing other than an austerity budget based on war. Michel Chasudovsky, a professor of economics at the University of Ottawa and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, noted that Obama's austerity measures hit all major federal spending programs with the exception of defense and the Middle East war, the Wall Street bank bailout, and interest payments on a staggering public debt. At first sight, the budget proposal has all the appearances of an expansionary program, a demand-oriented second New Deal geared towards creating employment, rebuilding shattered social programs, and reviving the real economy. The realities are otherwise. Obama's promise is based on a mammoth austerity program. The entire fiscal structure is shattered, turned upside down. Understandably, Chasudovsky concluded that the Obama plan largely serves the interests of Wall Street, the defense contractors, and the oil conglomerates. He warned that the Bush-Obama bank bailouts will lead America into a spiraling public debt crisis. The economic and social dislocations are potentially devastating, he added. What this means is that the American taxpayer has been made the lender of last resort for the two government-sponsored private enterprises, the Federal National Mortgage Association, Fannie Mae, and the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, Freddie Mac, whose combined debt of $5.4 trillion has been effectively transferred to the nation's balance sheet. In addition to personal debt, every American now has a financial responsibility for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, as well as other financial institutions. What is even more maddening was the use of some bailout funds to create extravagant golden parachute retirement and severance payments to financial executives who would have to leave their failing companies. These garnered unfavorable publicity in late 2008, as did the revelations of shady dealings between Wall Street and its regulators. Take, for instance, Charles Millard, former director of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, or PBGC, an independent federal corporation that protects the pension plans of nearly 44 million American workers and retirees. In May 2009, Millard was called to testify before the Senate Aging Committee over charges that he had cozy and improper contacts with Wall Street firms. Millard, citing his constitutional right to avoid self-incrimination, declined to answer questions. The PBGC, which insures corporate pensions, announced in late May 2009 that it had suffered a $33.5 billion deficit for the first half of the fiscal year, up considerably from a $10.7 billion deficit in 2008. According to hearing testimony by PBGC Inspector General Rebecca Ann Batts, Millard directly participated in granting more than $100 million in PBGC contracts to the international investment firms of BlackRock Incorporated, J.P. Morgan, and Goldman Sachs, against the advice of senior corporate management. Telephone and email records showed Millard had contacts with his prospective bidders prior to hiring them to manage real estate and private equity investments. Millard's experience illustrates both the incestuous relationship between persons in government who are supposed to be protecting the public and Wall Street. It is also noteworthy that Millard invoked the Fifth Amendment, just like mafia gangsters in the past. If there had been no wrongdoing, then why refuse to testify? Before the crash. Before the market crash in 2008, stress reached deep into certain strata of American life. Many retirees who once believed their money was safe saw principal losses of up to 80 or 90% of their investment. Serious market slowdown began when investment banks across the globe refused to buy one another's credit, an unusual move, and when mortgage purchasing companies Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae decided they could make more money by buying subprime mortgages. It was all part of the Bush administration's policy of conforming to the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, which were unveiled in 2000. These goals addressed such issues as the eradication of extreme poverty and hunger, universal primary education, gender equality, health improvement, and ensuring environmental sustainability. It was laudable goals such as these that led to government pressure on lending institutions to issue subprime mortgages. The result? Hundreds of thousands of unsold homes. Although it's well known that the economic mess began with the banks, mortgage lenders, and real estate companies, the current housing and mortgage mess actually was the result of maneuvering by both Democrats and Republican politicians, a fact that adds considerable weight to the argument that both major parties are controlled by the same globalists seeking to install a worldwide socialist system. During the 1990s, Bill Clinton's Democratic administration was pressuring Fannie Mae, the nation's largest underwriter of home mortgages, to expand mortgage loans to low and moderate income borrowers. After all, granting low-income families the chance for home ownership sounded good on paper. Fannie Mae has expanded home ownership for millions of families in the 1990s by reducing down payment requirements, Franklin D. Raines, chairman and CEO of Fannie Mae, told the New York Times in 1999. The newspaper noted that at least one study seemed to indicate racial prejudice in this lending, as it reported that 18% of such subprime loans went to black borrowers as compared to 5% for all other groups. With great prescience, Times writer Stephen A. Holmes noted in 1999, in moving, even tentatively, into this new area of lending, Fannie Mae is taking on significantly more risk, which may not pose any difficulties during flush economic times. But the government-subsidized corporation may run into trouble in an economic downturn, prompting a government rescue similar to that of the savings and loan industry in the 1980s. While Fannie Mae was lowering loan qualifications, its stockholders were pressuring for greater profits, creating a recipe for financial disaster. And, as usual, both the political and financial machinations involved crossed party lines, but not the agenda of the globalists. Larry Summers, a Treasury Secretary under Clinton, Obama's head of the National Economic Council, and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, is an advocate of cutting both corporate and capital gains taxes, and convinced Clinton to sign into law several Republican bills that allowed banks to expand their powers. One of these bills repealed the 1933 Glass-Steagall Act, which prevented the merger of commercial banks, insurance companies, and brokerage firms such as Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch. Additionally, Summers supported the Commodity Futures Modernization Act just before the 2000 election, which denied the governmental Commodity Futures Trading Corporation the ability to conduct oversight on the trading of financial derivatives. In the wake of Obama's stimulus package in April 2009, Summers was criticized for collecting $2.7 million in speaking fees from Wall Street companies that had received government bailout money. Summers was paving the way for the abuse of America's financial system. Meanwhile, his protege, Undersecretary for International Affairs, Timothy Geithner, was making political gains. In 2002, during the first George W. Bush administration, Geithner left the Treasury Department to join the Council on Foreign Relations as a senior fellow in the International Economics Department. Also a protege of Henry Kissinger, Geithner had previously served as president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank. By 2009, Geithner was Obama's Treasury Secretary. Again, here we see two men, Summers and Geithner, connected to the same secretive globalist society, the Council on Foreign Relations, or CFR, freely moving between both Democratic and Republican administrations. The CFR is secretive because it does not publicly announce its agenda or decisions, nor does it allow anyone to join without an invitation, and then only after careful vetting of the candidate's propensity to favor globalization. Princeton-educated economics researcher William F. Engdahl wrote that Treasury Secretary Geithner's dirty little secret was that during the credit crisis, he only tried to save the five largest banks, banks that held 96% of all U.S. bank derivative positions in terms of nominal value, and an eye-popping 81% of the total net credit risk exposure in the event of default. A derivative is a financial instrument whose worth is derived from another resource, whether property, goods, or services, called the underlying asset. Derivatives have been used in complex financial dealings to hedge against loss by allowing speculators to sell or trade the derivative and to gamble on gaining great profit by acquiring derivatives in the hope that the underlying asset will maintain or increase its value. In declining order, The five banks that had the most derivatives are J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citibank, Goldman Sachs, and the recently merged Wells Fargo, Wachovia. The leadership of these five banks is full of CFR members. Bank stress tests. In early May 2009, after months of foot-dragging, federal regulators finally released the results of their bank stress tests, which test whether or not a certain bank can repay its debts and survive harsh economies. From the five banks just listed, only J.P. Morgan Chase passed the test. This means it was not required to raise more capital to prevent further losses. The Charlotte-based Bank of America tested the worst on the stress tests. Government regulators informed the bank that it needed almost $34 billion in additional capital, which accounted for almost half of its total deficit. This news worsened problems for the banking giant, already under criticism for receiving more than $45 billion in government aid and for acquiring the investment bank Merrill Lynch. Bank of America wasn't the only one with problems. Among others, Wells Fargo needed to raise $13.7 billion. GMAC Financial Services, formerly known as General Motors Acceptance Corporation, needed $11.5 billion, and Citigroup needed $5.5 billion. All told, the nation's large banks needed $74.6 billion to build a capital cushion, according to federal regulators. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke was publicly upbeat about the tests, describing them as a fair and comprehensive effort. Markets can be reassured that banks will be strong and be able to lend even if the economy is worse than currently expected, he told CNBC. However, banks that failed the government stress test would be required to quickly come up with a plan to raise additional resources. One such plan was for the federal government to convert preferred shares bought by the U.S. Treasury into common stock. Douglas Elliott, a former J.P. Morgan Chase investment banker now with the Brookings Institution, told the Associated Press, "Essentially, what we'll be doing is swapping a kind of loan for actual ownership of a part of the bank, so it increases the taxpayer's risk but also increases the potential return." Increased taxpayer risk? This does not seem such a good idea in shaky financial times. Continuing to pour taxpayer money into these five banks without changing their operating system is tantamount to treating an alcoholic with unlimited free booze, said F. William Engdahl. The government bailout of AIG at more than $180 billion as of April 2009 has primarily gone to pay off AIG's credit default swap obligations to counterpart gamblers Goldman Sachs, Citibank, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Bank of America, the banks who believe they are too big to fail. In effect, these institutions today believe that they are so large that they can dictate the policy of the federal government. Some have called it a banker's coup d'etat. It is definitely not healthy. So the big bank pockets the money and the poor, strapped taxpayers are left with the bill, not to mention ownership of banks that continue to be troubled financially well into 2010. By mid-2009, Americans were driving less and spending less, and the economy was deflating. Even though products became cheaper in the face of inflation, people stopped buying what they couldn't afford. The housing market, which is a key indicator of economic strength, continued to lag far behind projections. Housing startups were doing particularly poorly. In April 2009, the U.S. Department of Housing and Development announced that non-government-backed housing starts, even after seasonal adjustments, were 54% lower, 458,000, than the April 2000 rate of 1,001,000. Privately backed housing starts are any homes being built that are not being financed by the government. These have long been a prime indicator of the national economy. There was also blame tossed at the unequal distribution of money. Chuck Collins, director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good for the Institute of Policy Studies, said, "In our view, extreme inequalities contributed to the economic collapse. This matters because wealth is power, the power to shape the culture, to distort elections, and shape government policy. A plutocracy is a rule by wealth, and more the priorities of the society are shaped by the interests of organized wealth." Improprieties and death. Apparently, the stress created by the gargantuan amounts of money involved in the economic squeeze can be hazardous to your health as well as your wealth. Stress may have contributed to the untimely deaths of at least 5 high-profile financial officers who died in the months following financial collapse in October 2008. In January 2009, German billionaire Adolf Merkel apparently threw himself under a train after losing money shorting Volkswagen stock. Patrick Rocha, an Irish property speculator who was close to both President Bill Clinton and British Prime Minister Tony Blair, was found shot in the head following the crash of the real estate market. Chicago real estate mogul Steve Good was found fatally shot in his car. Financial advisor René Thierry Magon de la Villouche reportedly committed suicide in his Manhattan office just before Christmas 2008 after losing both his and his client's money in the Bernie Madoff scandal. One particularly troubling death was that of Freddie Mac acting chief financial officer David Kellerman, who was found, the apparent victim of suicide, in his Vienna, Virginia home on April 22, 2009. In 2008, the U.S. Treasury Department had to pump $45 billion into the government-sponsored mortgage firm to shore up $50 billion in losses. Questions immediately arose over reports about Kellerman's role in the massive losses at Freddie Mac and about the nature of his death. One police spokesman told All Headline News that Kellerman died from a gunshot wound. Strangely enough, however, another police officer initially said he had hanged himself. There was one more controversy when reporters found that Kellerman was deeply involved in the Securities and Exchange Commission's and the U.S. Justice Department's investigations into questionable bookkeeping practices with Freddie Mac. Kellerman figured in several recent controversies at Freddie Mac, reported the Washington Post in April 2009. He and a group of company attorneys tussled with regulators in early March as the firm prepared to file its quarterly earnings report with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Kellerman's group insisted that Freddie Mac inform shareholders of the cost to the company in helping carry out the Obama administration's housing recovery plan. The regulators urged the company not to do so. This isn't the story of a guy who was trying to cover something up. It's the story of a guy who was trying to do the right thing, commented one housing industry veteran who asked for anonymity, apparently suspecting the possibility of danger in telling the truth in such matters. More than one conspiracy-minded researcher believed that something more than suicide was at work in Kellerman's death, and that there may have been other deaths connected to an effort to silence insiders who might have knowledge of the situation that someone does not want made public. In a statement from his Political Action Committee, perennial office seeker and conspiracy advocate Lyndon LaRouche said, "There is no evident motive for suicide in this case, but there is a motive for suppressing making Kellerman's views known. The guy is killed, probably murdered. He deserves justice. His right to justice is overriding. The question is, what else did David Kellerman know which influential circles did not want him to reveal?" The rich get richer. It has long been said that the rich get richer while the poor get poorer. Many researchers equate the term plutocracy, rule by the wealthy, with the New World Order. Although the belief that an organized plutocracy controls the world has long been derided as merely a conspiracy theory, G. William Domhoff, a professor in psychology and sociology at the University of California, Santa Cruz, has the statistics to prove its existence. Domhoff's first book, Who Rules America, was a controversial 1960s bestseller that argued that the United States is dominated by an elite political and economic ownership class. Using updated figures, Domhoff stated in a posting, "In the United States, wealth is highly concentrated in a relatively few hands. As of 2007, the top 1% of households, the upper class, owned 34.3% of all privately held wealth, and the next 19%, the managerial, professional, and small business stratum, had 50.3%, which means that just 20% of the people owned a remarkable 85%, leaving only 15% of the wealth for the bottom 80%, wage and salary workers. In terms of financial wealth, the total net worth minus the value of one's home, the top 1% of households had an even greater share, 42.2%. Domhoff defined total assets as the gross value of owner-occupied housing, plus other real estate owned by the household, cash and savings deposits, money market accounts, stocks and bonds, retirement plans, and other financial securities. He defined total liabilities as mortgage debt, consumer debt, including auto loans, and any other debt. According to Domhoff, wealth distribution has been extremely concentrated throughout American history. During the 19th century, the top 1% of wealth owners owned 40 to 50% of assets in large port cities like Boston, New York, and Charleston. He said this disparity remained stable during the 20th century. Although there were small declines in the aftermath of the New Deal and World War II, when most people were working and could save a little money, there were progressive income tax rates, too, which took some money from the rich to help with the government services. Then there was a further decline, or flattening, in the 1970s, but this time in good part due to a fall in stock prices, meaning that the rich lost some of the value in their stocks, wrote Domhoff. By the late 1980s, however, the wealth distribution was almost as concentrated as it had been in 1929, when the top 1% had 44.2% of all wealth. It has continued to edge up since that time, with a slight decline from 1998 to 2004. Before the economy crashed in the late 2000s and little people got pushed down again. Domhoff recorded that as of 2007, income inequality in the United States was at an all-time high for the past 95 years, with the top 0.01% receiving 6% of all U.S. wages, which is double what it was for that tiny slice in 2000. The top 10% received 49.7%, the highest since 1917. The numbers are even more shocking when viewed on a global scale. Using numbers from the World Institute for Development Economics Research, Domhoff concluded the top 10% of the world's adults control about 85% of global household wealth. That compares with a figure of 69.8% for the top 10% for the United States, the only industrialized democracy with a higher concentration of wealth in the top 10% than the United States is Switzerland, at 71.3%, he noted. At the same time, the U.S. government's income is declining. According to the White House, 2008 individual income tax receipts were estimated at $1.168 trillion. Yet when the tax receipts were tallied, the total was $155 billion, less than that, at $1.043 trillion. Domhoff's work presents a strong argument that wealth indeed equals power. Such power comes with the ability to donate to political parties, engage lobbyists, and provide grants to experts to think up new policies beneficial to the wealthy. Money also can hire public relations firms to improve one's image or make large donations to universities and cultural entities such as museums, music halls, and art galleries. Wealth, in the form of stock ownership, can be used to control whole corporations, which today have inordinate influence in society, media, and government. And just as wealth can lead to power, so can power lead to wealth. Recent presidents, such as Lyndon B. Johnson and Richard M. Nixon, entered office without an extraordinary amount of money, but left as millionaires. This is because those who control a government can use their positions to feather their own nests. Domhoff said this can be done by means of a favorable land deal for relatives at the local level, or perhaps a huge federal government contract to a new corporation run by friends who will hire you when you leave government. If we take a larger historical sweep and look cross-nationally, we are well aware that the leaders of conquering armies often grab enormous wealth, and that some religious leaders use their positions to acquire wealth, commented Domhoff. Public debt, private profit. Whether rich or poor, most Americans believe their finances are safe, thanks to a federal government corporation created in the Great Depression year of 1933. About 8,400 American banks participate in the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, an independent agency created by the Congress to maintain stability and public confidence in the nation's financial system by insuring deposits, supervising banks for safety and soundness, and managing receiverships. These banks allocate a small portion of their profits to collectively insure bank deposits in cases where a bank fails. And fail they did in late 2008 and 2009. Between the 2 years, 111 banks failed, and many more teetered on collapse, effectively depleting the FDIC reserve fund from $52.8 billion in 2008 to a mere $10.4 billion in the first quarter of 2009, its lowest point since the height of the savings and loan scandal in 1992. But what is more disturbing is that this reserve fund, much like Social Security, is merely an illusion. In 2008, the former chairman of the FDIC, William M. Isaac, wrote an article titled "The Mythical FDIC Fund," in which he revealed the FDIC's insolvency. When I became chairman of the FDIC in 1981, the FDIC's financial statement showed a balance at the U.S. Treasury of some $11 billion. I decided it would be a real treat to see all of that money. So I placed a call to then-Treasury Secretary Don Regan. The conversation went like this. Isaac: Don, I'd like to come over to look at the money. Regan: What money? Isaac: You know, the $11 billion the FDIC has in the vault at Treasury. Regan: Well, you see, Bill, that's a bit of a problem. Isaac: I know you're busy. I don't need to do it right away. Regan: Well, it's not a question of timing. I don't know quite how to put this, but we don't have the money. Isaac: Right. Regan: No, really. The banks have been paying money to the FDIC. The FDIC has been turning the money over to the Treasury, and the Treasury's been spending it on missiles, school lunches, water projects, and the like. The money's gone. Isaac: But it says right here on this financial statement that we have over $11 billion at the Treasury. Regan: In a sense, you do. You see, we owe that money to the FDIC, and we pay interest on it. Isaac: I know this might sound pretty far-fetched, but what would happen if we should need a few billion to handle a bank failure? Regan: That's easy. We'd go right out and borrow it. You'd have the money in no time. Same-day service, most days. Isaac: Let me see if I've got this straight. The money the banks thought they were storing up for the past half century, sort of saving it for a rainy day, is gone. If a storm begins brewing and we need the money, Treasury will have to borrow it. Is that about it?
Regan.
Yep.
Isaac. Just one more thing while I've got you. Why do we bother pretending there's a fund?
Regan.
I'm sorry, Bill, but the president's on the other line. I'll have to get back to you on that.
There is no record that Regan ever got back to Isaac.
Why do we bother pretending there's a fund? Asked Daryl Robert Shoon, economic commentator and author of How to Survive the Crisis and Prosper in the Process.
The answer is obvious. Modern economics, i.e. central banking, is a shell game where bankers, with the aid of governments, have foisted a highly lucrative fraud on society. And while the fraud of the FDIC fund is egregious, it is no more egregious than the fraud of the Fed or the economy itself.
And the fraud does not stop with the FDIC. Shoon and others believe modern banking is essentially a Ponzi scheme on a global scale, in which bankers loan non-existent money and receive repayment of the non-existent funds, plus compounding interest in return. In economies based on the fraudulent issuance of money as debt, there are only predators and victims. Bankers are the predators, society is the victim. Businessmen are victims who often believe they're predators. And governments are the well-paid-off referees in the rigged game being played out in today's capital markets, Shoon wrote. At the heart of this combination Ponzi scheme and shell game lies the privately owned Federal Reserve System. But you and I, dear listener, will get to that. Chris Martinson, a businessman with a doctorate in neurotoxicology from Duke University and an MBA in finance from Cornell, wrote, "Our entire monetary system, and by extension our economy, is a Ponzi economy in the sense that it really only operates well when in expansion mode. Even a slight regression triggers massive panics and disruptions that seem wholly inconsistent with the relative change. Unless one understands that expansion is more or less a requirement of our type of monetary and economic system. Without expansion, the system first labors and then destroys wealth far out of proportion to the decline itself. What fuels expansion in a debt-based money system? Why, new debt, or credit, of course. So one of the things we keep a very close eye on, as they do at the Federal Reserve, is the rate of debt creation. Martinson and others believe a major theme in the current credit bubble collapse is the extent to which private credit has been crumbling while the Federal Reserve has been purchasing debt and the federal government has been increasing its borrowing. In essence, public debt purchases and new borrowing has attempted to plug the gap left by a shortfall in private debt purchases and borrowing. That's the scheme right now. The Federal Reserve is creating new money out of thin air to buy debt, while the U.S. government is creating new debt at the most fantastic pace ever seen. The attempt here is to keep aggregate debt growing fast enough to prevent the system from completely seizing up, explained Martinson. Martinson, who said he continually seeks to accept or reject his own hypotheses based on the evidence at hand, explained that the Federal Reserve has been monetizing far more U.S. government debt than has openly been revealed by allowing foreign central banks to swap their agency debt for Treasury debt. This is not a sign of strength and reveals a pattern of trading temporary relief for future difficulties, Martinson wrote. When the full scope of this program is more widely recognized, more pressure will fall upon the dollar, as more and more private investors shun the dollar and all dollar-denominated instruments as stores of value and wealth. This will further burden the efforts of the various central banks around the world as they endeavor to meet the vast borrowing desires of the U.S. government. One possible result of the abandonment of these efforts is a wholesale flight out of the dollar and into other assets. To U.S. residents, this will be experienced as rapidly rising import costs and increasing costs for all internationally traded basic commodities, especially food items. For the rest of the world, the results will range from discomforting to disastrous,
depending on their degree of dollar linkage. The shell game that the Fed is currently playing does not change the basic equation. Money is being printed out of thin air so that it can be used to buy U.S. government debt. It has been long understood that creating more money leads to inflation, since the more currency in circulation, the less it's worth, especially paper money that has no intrinsic value. As to the government buying private debt, a crude example of what has happened goes like this. Tom has a mortgage on a very nice house. He has a good job and his credit is good. Dick lives in a run-down home badly in need of serious repairs and has been in and out of jobs, so he has a low credit score. Yet, due to government pressure on the lending industry to provide housing to all, Dick has a mortgage on his home. Through a scheme called bundling, Tom's mortgage and a few others like his are combined with Dick's mortgage and many others like his. By sleight of hand, this combined package of mortgages is given an A1 rating, and the package is sold to venture capital firms as a good investment. With these investment packages growing in number, the economy booms. But when the housing bubble breaks, the investment firms, many of the largest filled with globalists, turn to the government for relief, with the argument that if they go bankrupt, the whole national economy will suffer. The government then pays these firms for their investment at full value, even though many of the houses are substandard, subprime, and not worth full value. The government pays with taxpayer money, then orders more money printed to cover the shortfall. The investment firms are also paid with the condition that their money comes in the form of government bonds, which means even more paper is spread around, causing further inflation and devaluation. It is robbery on a grand scale, with the strapped taxpayer taking the hit, while the middlemen financiers continue to make a profit. To add insult to injury, many of these financiers are banks and investment houses outside the United States, which means U.S. taxpayers are paying back foreign investors for making bad investments.